Sloane was always less than anxious to see them. They didn't telephone ahead. As usual, he was too polite to close the door in their faces. He looked pale and defeated. He had lost weight. He invited them into the front hallway. The job hunting was going badly, he said, the taint of Watergate. Equally awful, there was no end in sight to the trials and civil suits and depositions that were making him a professional witness at about $20 a day. They didn't know how to respond. Visiting Sloane always made them feel like vultures. The reporters outlined what they had learned from Z, but Sloane said he could make no more sense of it than they. Then he was apologetic about the Haldeman debacle, and finally it became painfully clear what had happened that night in the rain. Sloane had misunderstood Woodward's question. Thinking that Woodward had inquired if Sloane would have named Haldeman before the grand jury had he been asked. Now he was more enlightening than before on Haldeman's relationship to the fund and to CRP. Bob ran the committee through Magruder until Mitchell and Secretary Stans came over in the first part of 72. Jeb authorized the first payments to Liddy. I think Liddy was still working at the White House at the time in the summer of 71. Actually, Haldeman stood behind all four who got bulk payments from the fund. Kalmbach, Liddy, Magruder, and Porter. Haldeman was insulated from the fund. Magruder, Kalmbach, Stans, and even Mitchell had effectively acted on his behalf, Sloane explained. Haldeman had never personally ordered Sloane to hand out any payments, but spending money was the province of the White House chief. Maury, Stans, frequently complained that too much money was being given out from the fund, he said. Woodward asked more about the structure of Haldeman's office. Chapin was the presidential appointment secretary, Strachan the political lieutenant, Larry Higby the office manager and major domo, and Alexander Butterfield supervised internal security and the paper flow to the president. Typing his notes that night, Woodward underlined the words internal security. That was the name of the Justice Department division in charge of government wiretapping, formerly headed by Robert Mardian. While Woodward typed his notes, Bernstein pulled out a 3-inch-thick file folder marked, To Be Checked. Several days earlier, Lawrence Meyer, a city staff reporter whose beat was the federal courthouse, had obtained a confidential copy of a routine legal agreement between the prosecutors and attorneys for the 7 Watergate defendants, whose trial was to begin on January 8th. Bernstein read the 12-page stipulation. It described telephone, travel, and bank records that the prosecution and defense had agreed were accurate. Most of the information was already known to the reporters. Two matters intrigued them, however. There was evidence that Gordon Liddy and Howard Hunt had traveled to Los Angeles together under false names on September 4, 1971, and also on January 7, 1972, and February 17, 1972. That included the period when both were working at the White House, months before the Watergate break-in. They also found a note that a telephone had been installed on August 16, 1971, in room 16 of the Executive Office Building, located at 17th Street and Pennsylvania Avenue, Northwest, Washington, D.C., and disconnected on March 15, 1972. It had been listed in the name and home address of Kathleen Chenow, of Alexandria, Virginia. There was no Kathleen Chenow in the phone book, but using a crisscross directory, Bernstein found a former roommate who said Miss Chenow had moved to Milwaukee. He reached her there. It took only a few minutes to establish that Kathleen Chenow had been the plumber's secretary. She didn't seem hesitant about talking. Bernstein, who could hardly remember the last time he had encountered a willing source, didn't know quite where to start. He finally asked her just who and what the plumbers were. Her answer was straightforward. The plumbers were Howard Hunt, Gordon Liddy, David Young, and Eagle Bud Krogh. They investigated leaks to the news media and reported to John Ehrlichman. Their office was in the Executive Office Building basement across from the White House. Technically, she had been David Young's secretary. He was on loan to Ehrlichman's staff from Dr. Henry Kissinger's office. Young had made regular reports to Ehrlichman on the progress of the plumbers' investigations. Krogh was one of Ehrlichman's principal deputies. Originally, the administration had wanted to study how close the New York Times version of the Pentagon Papers was to the actual documents, she explained. They tried to determine how the Pentagon Papers got out. That started it all, the business of looking for leaks. For a while, they were studying State Department leaks. They checked embassy cables and tried to put two and two together about whose desks the cables went across. Most of Mr. Hunt's work that I saw was State Department cables he had reviewed dealing with the substance of the Pentagon Papers. Bernstein asked if she could remember what specific leaks had been investigated. The Pentagon Papers, of course. Then there was a time when Jack Anderson was running columns on the administration, in December. They were checking for those leaks, too. Mr. Mardigan from the Justice Department came down to the basement two or three times during that period. There was another occasion when Mr. Mardigan was at a big meeting in Mr. Krogh's office with Liddy, Hunt, and three or four people I didn't recognize, Chenow said. And David, Young, used to talk to John Mitchell. I don't know what about. I don't know how often. He asked about the telephone listed in the stipulation. That was Mr. Hunt's phone. It was put in for me to answer and take messages for him. Mr. Barker always called on that phone. He was about the only one who ever called. It rang an average of once a week, sometimes two or three times a week. Hunt and Bernard Barker were always chummy on the phone. Mr. Hunt would usually say, "How are you? What have you been up to?" Sometimes when he talked to Mr. Barker, he spoke in Spanish. Apparently he liked to speak Spanish for some reason. No, I don't speak Spanish. I remember Mr. Hunt calling Mr. Barker and Barker's wife. Nobody else. Sometimes Mr. Liddy might have used the phone to talk to somebody Mr. Hunt had placed a call to. I guess it was Mr. Barker. Most of the phone calls were from August to November. The phone was taken out March 15th. By then, it hadn't been used in ages. Bernstein asked the obvious. Why would a telephone in the White House complex, which had the benefit of the most sophisticated communication system in the world, be listed in the name and address of an individual in Alexandria? That's a good question, she replied. They apparently wanted it in my name because they didn't want any ties with the White House. For what reason, I don't know. Bills for the phone service had been mailed to her home, and she had sent them to another Ehrlichman deputy, John Campbell. So the White House would pay them. Apparently it had been arranged by Mr. Hunt, Mr. Young, and Mr. Liddy. They had talked to Mr. Campbell, and he would take care of it. Chenow had left the White House staff on March 30th, 1972, and was traveling in Europe at the time of the Watergate arrests. About 2 weeks later, she was located in Birmingham, England, by John Dean's assistant, Fred Fielding. "He had flown to Europe to pick me up," she said. "He said the White House was talking to the FBI, and that they, the White House and the FBI, were going to have an investigation. Apparently the FBI had asked Mr. Dean to find me. Mr. Fielding requested that I come back, and said that I should just recall my work, and that they would ask me questions about the telephone and to try and recall. On the flight back, Mr. Fielding gave me a Time magazine and tried to bring me up to date. He asked, 'Do you know anybody in the articles on the break-in?' And I said, 'Of course, Mr. Hunt.'" She had reported to John Dean's office at 8:45 a.m. the day after her return, the first week of July. Fielding and David Young were also there. "Mr. Dean said I'd be interviewed by the FBI at 9, that I would be asked what my role was, whether I knew about the bugging, and to give perfectly straightforward answers to the best of my ability." The interview had lasted about 40 minutes, as Dean, Fielding, and Young sat by silently. There were no questions asked by Mr. Dean, and he didn't take any notes. Afterwards, she had talked briefly with Young. He seemed kind of surprised that something like that, the bugging, could happen. He knew the telephone was in. I think after the whole thing came out, he put two and two together. The same week, Chenow had met with the Watergate prosecutors and testified before the Watergate grand jury. "Silbert never asked about Ehrlichman," she said, "just Colson, besides Hunt and Liddy and Young." Bernstein's conversation with Chenow had lasted more than an hour and a half. The next morning, Pearl Harbor Day, Woodward called Jack Harrington, the Chesapeake and Potomac Telephone Company official in charge of White House service, who confirmed that Ehrlichman's office had ordered the phone and had arranged the unusual billing system, the first of its kind he'd seen in 25 years. Both reporters, meanwhile, had been told by White House sources that John Campbell had been Ehrlichman's office manager. There was no chance that the phone would have been installed without Ehrlichman's approval, the sources said. By late afternoon, Bernstein had completed a 2,000-word story on the secret phone installation, on Chenow's report about the plumbers, and on her interview with John Dean. Gerald Warren, the deputy presidential press secretary, told Woodward there would be no White House comment, because it might affect the upcoming trial. By not commenting, Bernstein wrote in the fifth paragraph, the White House left unanswered the questions of how Hunt's official duties could require a camouflage telephone listing, and why Ehrlichman's office would approve the arrangements for such phone service. To his chagrin, Bernstein was alone in his enthusiasm for the story. For the first time, someone had said for the record that the plumbers existed, that Ehrlichman's office was involved in their activities, and that Hunt and other presidential aides had investigated leaks. Rosenfeld didn't seem much interested in the story, and left it to Sussman. Sussman and Woodward were lukewarm, and thought it didn't prove anything. Bradley expressed relief more than anything else. Regardless of its shortcomings, it was the Post's first strong Watergate story since the Haldeman report. He was inclined to give it a B-, but assigned extra points because its primary source was mentioned by name. The White House could argue its meaning, but not the facts. He wanted the story on the front page, if for no other reason than to demonstrate that 5 weeks after George McGovern's defeat, the Post was still in the Watergate business. That night, Bernstein and Woodward left aboard a 747 for Los Angeles, hoping that, if they got lucky, Donald Segretti would be more forthcoming than during Bernstein's last trip. Copies of Hunt's and Liddy's travel records were in their suitcases, and Woodward had talked by telephone to a secretary in Herbert Kalmbach's law firm who had seemed friendly. On the flight out, Bernstein got into a high-stakes poker game in the lounge of the 747. He was about $30 ahead when Woodward wandered back and asked to join, arousing Bernstein's protective instincts. Sometimes Bernstein worried that his partner didn't have enough street savvy to keep himself out of trouble. Woodward, conversely, frequently worried that Bernstein would be all too comfortable in fast company. But Woodward held his own against the high rollers and broke even. Bernstein won $35 in the $5 ante game. Woodward, Bernstein didn't know, had spent a lot of weekends in Las Vegas while stationed at the Navy base in San Diego. That night they stayed in a $9-a-night tourist home in Marina Del Rey. All the hotels in Donald Segretti's swinging harbor village were filled, and Segretti wasn't home. The next day they drove to the Beverly Wilshire Hotel, a Beverly Hills elephant of marble and red velvet plush where Hunt and Liddy had stayed in September 1971. The reporters talked to the security chief there, an elderly former police captain who had no idea where the hotel's telephone records were kept. The hotel's chief accountant, who might have received his CPA and green eye shades from Central Casting on the other side of Santa Monica Boulevard, was only slightly more helpful. Surrounded by stacks of bills and financial statements in his disheveled backroom office, he resolutely informed the reporters that he had given the FBI his word never to discuss Hunt's and Liddy's visit. In a corridor, Bernstein asked the accountant's secretary if she would care for a drink in the bar, then or later. "You're kidding," she said, and walked off slowly. Bernstein said he wasn't kidding. "You should be," she said. Woodward later reached one of Segretti's alleged contacts on the telephone and proposed a visit. "I'll shoot you if you come out here," he replied. Woodward drove south to Kalmbach's law office at Newport Beach. The president's personal lawyer was out of town. The secretary, to whom Woodward had spoken on the phone, gave him a cup of coffee and offered her opinion. "Mr. Kalmbach is one of the finest men I know. He is an honest man, and when all of this is over, you will understand that. She would say no more. At Kalmbach's home, a woman came to the door and said, "Absolutely not," when he asked for a moment of her time. She escorted Woodward out the inner courtyard gate and slammed it behind him. They ate lunch with Larry Young, Segretti's ex-friend who had been so helpful in October. He knew nothing new. After 4 days, they finally reached Segretti by phone, and he agreed to meet them in a nearby Howard Johnson's. Over milkshakes and banana splits, they talked for about an hour. Segretti was unyielding about talking for the record in the foreseeable future. The reporters returned to Washington on the night of December 11th. At the White House press briefing the next noonday, Ron Ziegler pressed again on the matter of Howard Hunt's secret telephone and the plumbers, gave the first White House acknowledgment that the plumbers had been in the business of investigating leaks to the news media. But he seemed to deny that either Howard Hunt or Gordon Liddy had been a plumber. "To the best of my knowledge," said Ziegler, "Liddy was never assigned to the team." "Hunt?" "I don't believe so, no." Neither Bernstein nor Woodward had attended Ziegler's briefing. Convinced that they could learn more elsewhere, and concerned that their presence might further personalize Ziegler's responses, they customarily avoided the White House press room. That afternoon, Bernstein and Woodward wrote the story of Ziegler's remarks from notes taken at the briefing by Carol Kilpatrick, the Post's veteran White House correspondent. The reporters had a special fondness for Kilpatrick, who had been a Washington reporter for more than half of his 60 years, and had covered the White House since the Kennedy administration. If anyone at the Post had suffered as a result of the paper's Watergate coverage, it was Kilpatrick. Many of his old sources on the Nixon staff refused to talk to him after November 7th, when it no longer served their purposes. Of those few who were still talking to him after the election, Kilpatrick did not know which, if any, to trust. A disillusioning experience for any reporter who had dealt in good faith with those he covered. Kilpatrick, like most of his colleagues in the White House press corps, was skeptical of much of what Bernstein and Woodward had written. But he had never imposed his own judgment on their stories. The story on Kathleen Chenow and the plumbers seemed to dull Kilpatrick's previous skepticism. "There has to be a lot more meaning in that story than meets the eye," he said. Around this time, the White House began excluding the Post from covering social events at the Executive Mansion. First, a large Republican dinner. Then, a dinner for past, present, and newly designated cabinet officers. Then, a Sunday worship service. Finally, a Christmas party for the children of foreign diplomats. The immediate target was Post reporter Dorothy McCardle, a gentle 68-year-old grandmotherly fixture of the Washington Press Corps, who had covered White House social events for 5 administrations. On the same day Mrs. McCardle was barred from a prayer meeting at the White House, Bernstein had dinner with friends, among them a reporter from the Washington Star. The Star reporter told him an interesting story about a conversation he'd had with Colson a few days before November 7th. "As soon as the election is behind us, we're really going to shove it to the Post," he quoted Colson as saying. "All the details haven't been worked out yet, but the basic decisions have been made at a meeting with the president." Colson advised the Star reporter to start coming around with a breadbasket because we're going to fill it up with news that would make reading the Star indispensable while freezing out the Post. "And that's only the beginning. After that, we're really going to get rough. They're going to wish on L Street, location of the Post, that they'd never heard of Watergate." Soon, challenges against the Post's ownership of 2 television stations in Florida were filed with the Federal Communications Commission. The price of Post stock on the American exchange dropped by almost 50%. Among the challengers, forming the organization of citizens who proposed to become the new FCC licensees, were several persons long associated with the president. Chapter 11. Judge Sirica wanted Bernstein and Woodward in his courtroom at 10 a.m. on December 19th. A hearing before the judge on another matter involving the press, a defense motion to force the Los Angeles Times to turn over tapes and notes of its interview with Alfred C. Baldwin, was already scheduled for that hour. The reporters dressed neatly for their day in court. Woodward got his hair trimmed. The courtroom was packed, mostly with media people who were there for the confrontation over the tapes. Bernstein and Woodward took seats in the second row. Sirica, they learned at precisely 10 o'clock, was capable of expressing his displeasure with a frown so deep as to leave no doubt about his reputation for toughness. He had decided to make the reporters the first order of business. The grand jurors had entered the courtroom. The audience obeyed the command of all rise. The judge's frown deepened. "Oh, boy," Woodward whispered to Bernstein, bouncing on his toes and sucking in his breath so the words sounded as if he were ordering a horse to stop. Bernstein was contemplating which fate he preferred, the ignominy of being stripped naked in front of his colleagues for his half-assed conduct, or the mitigating honor of being dispatched by Maximum John. "It has recently come to my attention," Sirica began recounting the unfortunate facts. Grand jurors had been approached over the first weekend of December in an attempt to get information. But judging from the transcript of the prosecutor's subsequent discussion of the matter with the grand jury, no information had been disclosed. Thus, the investigation had not been compromised. The jurors were to be commended for their silence. Their resolve could only be strengthened if once more they were reminded of the oath which had bound their deliberations sacred and secret. The judge peered out into the audience. "Now, I want it understood by the person who approached members of this grand jury that the court regards the matter as extremely serious." The reporters were hanging on the judge's every word now, less confident than before that Ed Williams and the prosecutors had been convincing in their arguments. Sirica was scowling. He noted, thoughtfully, that the person who had attempted to subvert the sanctity of the grand jury proceedings was neither defendant nor counsel, but a news media representative. A buzz in the assembled press corps. Who among them? Bernstein and Woodward waited for the judge to unmask them and, maybe, to ask if they wished to throw themselves on the mercy of the court. First, however, Sirica desired to point out the legal ramifications, and to remind the assembly that attempting to gain information from a grand juror is, at least potentially, a contemptuous offense. Then he excused the grand jury and strode from the court. The clerk declared a recess. It took the reporter several moments to understand what had happened, that that was the end of it. They had gone free. Bernstein and Woodward tried to look nonchalant as their colleagues asked who they thought was guilty. They declined to speculate. Dan Shore of CBS, who knew a sham when he spotted one, was the first to suggest privately that Bernstein and Woodward were the offenders. "Hearsay, innuendo, and character assassination," protested Bernstein. Shore responded with a knowing smile. The reporters had reluctantly agreed during a rush to the halls that only as a last resort would they deny the allegation outright. Maybe they could get by with indignation and artful footwork. The confused scene in the hallway didn't lend itself to careful thought. 2 dozen of their colleagues were shouting private theories or polling one another in search of the guilty party. Accused again, Woodward said the first thing that came into his head. The grand jury contact had taken place over the first weekend in December. That was 6 weeks after he and Bernstein had written a major story. Somehow the compelling illogic of the syllogism got by. Bernstein, feeling grubby, listened raptly to another newsman explain why the offender was probably a radio or television reporter, not someone from a newspaper. Sirica specifically used the phrase news media representative. That's the term he always uses when he's talking about radio and television reporters. When he means newspaper reporters, he says the press. "Yeah," said Bernstein. He thought that he had noticed that, too. Woodward and Bernstein were trying to avoid a colleague who was interviewing reporters in the hallway about the session in Sirica's courtroom. He caught up with Woodward in the elevator and asked point blank if the judge had been referring to him or Bernstein. "Come off it. What do you think?" Woodward answered angrily. The man persisted. "Well, was it one of them or wasn't it? Yes or no?" "Listen," Woodward snapped. "Do you want a quote? Are we talking for the record? I mean, are you serious? Because if you are, I'll give you something, all right?" The reporter seemed stunned. "Sorry, Bob, I didn't think you'd take me seriously," he told Woodward. The danger passed. The nightmare vision that had haunted them all day, Ron Ziegler at the podium demanding that they be the object of a full federal investigation, or some such thing, disappeared. They tried to imagine what choice phrases he might use. Jury tampering? And they realized that they didn't have the stomach for it. They felt lousy. They hadn't broken the law when they visited the grand jurors. That much seemed certain. But they had sailed around it and exposed others to danger. They had chosen expediency over principle, and, caught in the act, their role had been covered up. They had dodged, evaded, misrepresented, suggested, and intimidated, even if they had not lied outright. That afternoon, Woodward returned to Judge Sirica's courtroom for the hearing on the Los Angeles Times Baldwin material. The notes, tapes, and related documents of reporters Jack Nelson and Ronald Ostrow had been subpoenaed by lawyers for the Watergate defendants. The Times interview with Baldwin had been the most vivid piece of journalism in the whole Watergate saga, definitively portraying the difference between a third-rate burglary attempt and the brand of political gang warfare practiced by the president's men. Woodward, remembering his own dealings with Alfred Baldwin's lawyers, doubted there would have been any interview without assurances that the tapes and notes would remain in the Times' possession. Certainly the stories Bernstein and he had done could not have been written without such guarantees. The judge ordered John F. Lawrence, the Los Angeles Times bureau chief in Washington, to turn over the tapes, which the paper had placed in his custody. "I must respectfully decline," Lawrence, a thin man in his late 30s, said mildly. Sirica held him in contempt and ordered him jailed. Lawrence's lawyer argued strenuously that jailing him while the First Amendment issue was being considered on appeal would serve no purpose. He also pointed out that it was Christmas time and that Mr. Lawrence had a wife and small children. But Sirica would not be swayed, and the marshals led Lawrence off to jail, not even permitting him to say goodbye to his wife. Bernstein had rarely seen Woodward so shaken. They were both painfully aware of the contrast. Lawrence, whose only offense had been to act professionally and to follow his conscience, was in jail. They had gotten off with a lecture and with their secret intact. Lawrence spent several hours in a basement cell before the U.S. Court of Appeals released him pending appeal. 3 days later, attorneys for Alfred Baldwin announced that he was voluntarily releasing the Los Angeles Times from its agreement to keep the tapes confidential. The tapes were handed over to the court. The grand jury adventure was not the reporters' last encounter with Judge Sirica or the prosecutors. Several days after their court appearance, Woodward phoned a former secretary in the office of Morton B. Jackson, a Los Angeles lawyer with whom Hunt had stayed during the week following the Watergate break-in. Woodward identified himself and explained that he knew she had been interviewed by the FBI. "Leave me alone," she said. "I have my life to live. I can't stand it. Why do you want to bother me?" Woodward said that he was checking information which indicated that she knew something about the purpose of Howard Hunt's and Gordon Liddy's travels to the West Coast. "I'm nobody. Nobody at all. Leave me alone." She was crying. Woodward ended the conversation. The next day, Bradley called Woodward and Bernstein to his office. "Williams got another call from the prosecutors. Some woman from California complained that one of you phoned her and said you were an FBI agent." Bernstein broke up laughing at the thought of Woodward as an FBI agent, but Bradley was serious. During the hearing on the Baldwin tapes, Sirica had directed all potential witnesses in the case not to talk to reporters until after the trial. "Now we're back with Sirica," Bradley said. "The prosecutors had to go to the judge. They don't think you posed as an FBI agent, but they think you might have violated the witness rule." Bradley said that Ed Williams would visit Sirica again. Bernstein complained that it would be impossible to continue the investigation if he and Woodward couldn't talk to witnesses. Bradley agreed. "Until we get it settled," he said, "you're going to have to stay away from witnesses completely." The reporters asked how they were supposed to know whether someone was a witness. "No way," Bradley said. "So you'll have to stop your reporting, that is, stop digging new ground until this is settled." For the first time in 6 months, Bernstein and Woodward were called off. 2 days later, Bradley put new ground rules in writing. Copies went to Rosenfeld, Sussman, Woodward, and Bernstein. "Williams talked to Sirica this morning. It is okay for us to talk to witnesses, provided that the minute a witness tells us he or she has been forbidden by the court to talk to us, we call off the dogs. And that means the minute they tell us that. In other words, we cannot try to talk a witness into talking if that witness has expressed an understanding that he or she is not supposed to talk. We must live up to the spirit and the letter of this ground rule. Later that week, they stopped by the office of Earl Silbert to discuss the guidelines. It was about 9 p.m., and the courthouse was almost deserted. Silbert seemed in a good mood. As usual in such sessions, he refused to discuss the case substantively, and they all chatted about the election. The chief prosecutor was a registered Democrat, and his wife, an artist, had been a volunteer in the McGovern campaign. She had used her maiden name so that there would be no unfair connections made between her political activities and the prosecution of the Watergate case. Like almost everything about Silbert, his office was meticulous. His mother had once told an interviewer that Earl was so fastidious that he lined up the heels of his shoes in the closet. The stacks of file folders and papers that covered almost every available inch of surface space in the room were arranged in perfect piles. Woodward noticed a letter on Silbert's desk and recognized the letterhead. The Watkins Johnson Company of Rockville, Maryland. Woodward knew it was the company where McCord had bought some of the equipment used to bug the Watergate. He mentioned it to Bernstein as they took a cab back to the post. "So what?" Bernstein said. Woodward didn't know. But he got on the phone to the company the next morning and learned that McCord had left his CRP calling card when he bought the equipment and had paid with $100 bills, 35 of them. Woodward wrote a brief story about the transaction, which ran December 23rd, on the inside of the paper. The next Monday, Bernstein got a call from Silbert saying that he wanted to see the two of them in his office at once. Bernstein had no idea what Silbert wanted. Woodward figured that Silbert had put together the information on the $3,500 radio, and their having seen the letter on his desk. Bernstein thought it was inconceivable that Silbert would be calling them down for such a trivial matter, especially since they already had some documents on McCord's purchase. When they arrived, Silbert and his associate, Seymour Glanzer, were wearing very stern expressions. Silbert demanded to know the source of the radio story. The letter was in the same position on his desk, at the far left-hand corner, clearly in sight from where Woodward sat. Woodward said he had seen the letter and decided to call Watkins Johnson to learn if anything new had come up about the equipment since the reporters had last checked. "For me to believe that," Silbert said, "you're going to have to tell me your original source of information." They refused. Silbert was persuaded that their information had come from the letter, and only the letter. He threatened to circulate a memorandum in the U.S. Attorney's office telling everyone about the incident and recommending that no one there ever again talk with Woodward or Bernstein. He was considering taking legal action. If he let something slip in conversation, Silbert added, it was perfectly proper for the reporters to use it, but to get information off someone's desk was sneaky and outrageous. Glanzer said it was dishonest. Bernstein had learned years before that the ability to read upside down could be a useful reportorial skill. But he didn't disagree strongly with the prosecutors, and he apologized profusely. Woodward also apologized, but he thought Silbert and Glanzer were being irrational, and said so. Silbert said he didn't know if he could ever trust the two reporters again. If the prosecutors took any action on the matter, Woodward and Bernstein didn't hear of it. In December, a few weeks before the trial of the Watergate Seven was to begin, Woodward went to lunch with Sussman and Rosenfeld at the Jefferson Hotel. The editors, fraternally but insistently, wanted to know more about where the Post's Watergate investigation was going. Woodward had his fantasies about the future of Watergate. One was that Gordon Liddy invites Bernstein and Woodward out to his home, gives them drinks, and spends the evening telling them the whole story while they get it on tape. The editors weren't interested in his fantasies. They wanted more legwork. Woodward inquired who was going to cover the trial for the Post. Rosenfeld said he hadn't decided. Woodward felt that he and Bernstein should cover it. Rosenfeld disagreed. More than ever, he said, it was important that the Post have irreproachably objective coverage. Other reporters more removed from the story should be assigned. Woodward insisted that they had earned the chance. Rosenfeld glared at Woodward and said no decision had been made. Several days later, Rosenfeld informed the reporters that he had chosen Lawrence Meyer, the regular federal court reporter. Woodward and Bernstein were to continue their investigation. One of them would attend the trial each day, looking for leads in the testimony. Rosenfeld was right, but the reporters didn't realize it at the time. They were resentful. The case was moving into a new phase. They were afraid the Post might write off the earlier Watergate stories as the excesses of the young. Their fears increased when, just before the trial, Bernstein and Woodward drafted a long news analysis. Based on days of research, including long interviews with Justice Department officials, the burden of their story was that the government's case would leave most questions about the financing and sponsorship of the Watergate operation unanswered, and ignore the extensive campaign of political espionage and sabotage. Rosenfeld rejected the piece. "Let's wait and see what happens, then report." 2 days before the opening of the trial, Bernstein heard that the Miami men were staying in a high-rise apartment house in Arlington, Virginia, with their families and lawyers. That night he visited one of the men and was told of the defense with which they all hoped to support their not-guilty pleas. They would contend that they had been assured the Watergate raid was approved by high government officials and, therefore, that they had been working clandestinely on an authorized mission. There was one snag, Bernstein was told. Howard Hunt, though he wanted a unified defense, was vehemently opposed to any courtroom strategy that might suggest the conspiracy extended beyond the seven defendants. On the morning of January 8th, the opening day of the trial, a gray and gaunt Hunt arrived at the courthouse wearing a black top coat with a small, aristocratic, though slightly frayed, fur collar. He puffed on his pipe and paced the corridors, whispering frequently to his partner, Gordon Liddy. The two walked down the hall talking. Hunt, whose wife had died in a plane crash a few weeks before, held his arm high on Liddy's neck as if seeking support. Liddy had arrived smoking a large cigar, smiling, waving, and strutting confidently. Later in the day, when he was introduced to the prospective jurors, he bounded to his feet and waved his right hand triumphantly, like a politician greeting a crowd. The four Miami men, looking tense, appeared with their attorney, Henry B. Rothblatt, who wore a toupee and had a small mustache that appeared to be accented with eyebrow pencil. McCord, looking serious, came in a few minutes later. He warded off reporters' questions with a no comment. The members of the prosecution team, Earl Silbert, 36, Seymour Glanzer, 46, and Donald E. Campbell, 35, were spruce and well-groomed. Each carried a foot-thick stack of files. As they got off the elevator, reporters swarmed on them. "All your questions will be answered," Glanzer said. "Just wait." U.S. District Court Chief Judge John J. Sirica, who had assigned the case to himself, sat high on the bench, his wavy black hair making him look much younger than his 68 years. At a pretrial hearing in December, he had expressed his intentions. "This jury is going to want to know, what did these men go into that headquarters for? Was their sole purpose political espionage? Were they paid? Was there financial gain? Who hired them? Who started this?" Sirica's critics, and he had many in knowledgeable legal circles, including the prosecutors, contended that a trial was not the place to conduct an investigation. That task properly belonged to the grand jury. Woodward and Bernstein both attended the first day of the trial and listened as Silbert presented a 2-hour opening statement. The chief prosecutor seemed rather exasperated when he said that he would be able to account for only $50,000 of $235,000 in presidential campaign funds that had been handed to Gordon Liddy in $100 bills. Basing his theory primarily on the statements of Jeb Magruder and Herbert L. Porter, Silbert contended that Liddy had been given the funds to conduct legitimate intelligence-gathering activities. Liddy, Silbert said, had gone off on his own and planned and executed the illegal Watergate operation. It was the CRP cover story that had been described to the reporters months earlier during their evening visits. As Silbert spun out his tale of low-level conspiracy, Woodward sat among other reporters, furiously taking notes. He didn't have to write a story, so he could just think about what Silbert was saying. He recalled a lesson he had learned in his freshman year at Yale. The instructor had assigned the students to read some medieval documents that gave somewhat conflicting accounts of Henry IV's famous visit to Canossa in 1077 to seek Pope Gregory's forgiveness. According to all of them, the king had waited barefoot in the snow outside the Vatican for days. Woodward had pored over the documents, made notes, and based his paper on the facts on which most accounts agreed. All the witnesses had Henry IV out there in the snow for days with his bare feet. The instructor had failed Woodward because he had not used common sense. No human being could stand for days barefoot in the snow and not have his feet freeze off, the instructor said. The divine right of kings did not extend to overturning the laws of nature and common sense. As Silbert worked himself up into a state of indignation against Gordon Liddy, the boss of the whole operation, he said, Woodward wondered if Silbert had taken a good freshman history course at Harvard. Silbert, a Phi Beta Kappa graduate, had all this evidence. 60 witnesses. An airtight case. There was only one thing wrong. It didn't make sense. CRP would not have paid $235,000 for inconsequential intelligence which was readily available from the FBI and local police. CRP's managers would have wanted to know the exact purposes of the expenditures and the precise results. Silbert had told Bernstein and Woodward that he expected to please no one with his Watergate investigation. He was going to succeed, that seemed clear. He had repeatedly stressed that there was no evidence to indict any more than the 7 men who had been caught. There's an unwritten rule in the Justice Department. The higher up you go, the more you have to have them by the balls. And I think it's a good rule. After the opening statement, Howard Hunt changed his plea to guilty. He told reporters outside the courtroom that no higher-ups were involved in the conspiracy, to my personal knowledge. Bernstein had been told the day before by a member of the Miami contingent that the 4 Florida men might also plead guilty if Hunt did. The rumors persisted. On Friday afternoon, after the session ended, Bernstein and Woodward were standing outside the courthouse with Post columnist Nicholas Van Hoffman and Post editorial writer Roger Wilkins. Henry Rothblatt, the Miami men's lawyer, was standing on a corner with his clients trying to hail a taxi. "We'll lose them," Bernstein said, "unless one of us goes." Woodward agreed. Bernstein said he wanted to go. Woodward gave him $20. Rothblatt and his clients found a cab as Bernstein raced toward them. The lawyer, the stocky Frank Sturgis, and the 3 other men filled the cab, but Bernstein, uninvited, got in anyway, piling in on top of them as the door slammed. Von Hoffman and Wilkins nearly fell off the curb, laughing. Woodward wrote a note to himself that Bernstein owed him $20. Bernstein arrived back in the office late Saturday, mole-eyed and wrinkled. He had gone to the airport with Rothblatt and his clients, bought a ticket on a flight one of them was taking, edged his way in by offering to carry a suitcase and engaging in friendly banter, and slipped into an adjoining seat. Bernstein didn't really have to press the man too hard to turn the conversation around at the trial. The story came out in a restful flow of conversation as the jet engine surged peacefully in the background. The interview was costing the Post more than $1 a minute, Bernstein thought. According to the man on the plane, Hunt had been visiting the 4 men from Miami for a week, urging them to change their pleas to guilty. Their families would be cared for financially, and they could count on executive clemency after a few months in jail. In the enduring CIA fraternity, Hunt, the seasoned case officer, was again passing out the orders to his lower-level operatives. For more than a decade, the men had had unquestioned trust in Hunt, even after he had supervised their participation in the Bay of Pigs operation. He was their leader, the tie between their own projects and the cause of American patriotism. Rothblatt, Bernstein learned, was furious, and had instructed his clients to stay away from that son of a bitch Hunt. But it was too late. The guilty pleas would be entered the next week. On the phone to Woodward, Hunt's attorney, William Bittman, denied that his client was pressuring the Miami men. "I would think that the suggestion is absurd. I can't conceive of it," he said. The reporters and post-managing editor Howard Simons discussed the story. They were nervous about running it. Judge Sirica might haul the reporters into court again, this time to find out their source and begin an investigation of what appeared to be an obstruction of justice. Simons asked some of the Post lawyers about the prospects of Sirica ordering such disclosure. Opinion was divided as the deadline neared. Excessive caution prevailed, and the story on Hunt was held for more consideration the next day. One thing was certain, if it ran, it would carry only one reporter's byline. If Sirica demanded disclosure, only one of them would probably have to go to jail for refusing to name their sources. That night, both Bernstein and Woodward were called at home. A New York Times story said that the four Miami men were still being paid by persons as yet unnamed. The story, by Seymour M. Hirsch, also said that Watergate burglar Sturgis had acknowledged that he had been told that John Mitchell had been aware of the Watergate operation and had in fact encouraged the team. The next day, Time magazine sent out a press release of a forthcoming story that said that the four Miami men had been promised up to $1,000 for each month they spent in jail. An account by Jack Anderson pushed the matter further. Most of the money for the defendants has been funneled through Hunt, who delivered part of the cash to Bernard Barker, the columnist said. The stories eased Simon's qualms. Sirica will have to throw the reporters from Time, the New York Times, and Jack Anderson in jail, along with you guys, he said. The next day, Monday morning, the story on Hunt's maneuvers ran in the Post. In court that morning, the four Miami men fired Rothblatt and were assigned a new attorney, who immediately entered guilty pleas for them. Sirica was seething. After accepting the new pleas, he called the four men from Miami before him. They walked up and stood before the bench. Defendant Barker bounced up and down on his toes, wringing his hands behind his back. Apparently torn by the anxiety of the moment, he went into a deep knee bend. As he answered the judge's questions, his head wagged up and down and sideways in short jerks, as if his neck had turned to rubber. Judge Sirica asked about these $100 bills that were floating around like coupons. Barker replied that he didn't know where they had come from. The others nodded. I got the money in the mail in a blank envelope, he said. Well, I'm sorry, replied Sirica. I don't believe you. Sirica questioned the men for about an hour. The heads of all four defendants seemed to be attached to the same strings. They bobbed up and down in unison. Yes, they said, the decisions to plead guilty were made free from any pressure. No, Your Honor, they said, when asked if anyone had mentioned executive clemency. The judge's frown deepened. Had any of the men ever worked for the CIA? Not that I know of, answered Defendant Martinez, who had been on a CIA retainer of $100 a month until the day after his Watergate arrest. Among those who laughed out loud was Gordon Liddy, who had finished a brief nap at the defense table when Sirica began questioning the men. Why did you break into the Watergate? Sirica asked. It pertained toward the Cuban situation, Martinez said. When it comes to Cuba and when it comes to communist conspiracies involving the United States, I will do anything to protect this country against any communist conspiracy. Sirica rolled his eyes in disbelief. What, he asked, did the Democratic headquarters have to do with Cuba or the communist conspiracy? I don't know, Martinez said, and added that that was what Barker and Hunt had told him. All four denied that they had received any money. These are not men that sell themselves for money, Barker said proudly. Were you working under the direction of Mr. Hunt, or other people in this job that was pulled off? Sirica asked Barker. I was working with Mr. Hunt, and I wish to state that I was completely identified with Mr. Hunt. I have the greatest honor and distinguish him, Barker said. As Sirica interrogated them, Chief Prosecutor Silbert shook his head in disgust and stared at the yellow legal pad in front of him. Glanzer leaned back in his chair and rubbed one side of his face. The prosecutor's assurances that everything would come out of the trial were fading into nothingness as the defendants ducked into the haze of their guilty pleas. Sirica asked Barker about the $114,000 in Nixon campaign checks that had been deposited in his Miami bank account. Barker said he just didn't know where the money had come from. Now, wasn't that strange? Sirica asked.
I don't think it is strange, Your Honor, replied Barker. I have previously before this been involved in other operations which took the strangeness out of that, as far as I was concerned.
The Miami Four were led off to jail. That noon, Woodward took a cab back to the post for a lunch with Catherine Graham and Howard Simons. Catherine wants to go over some of the stories and ask about the sources, Simon said. Mrs. Graham, the publisher, was the daughter of Eugene Meyer, who bought the paper in 1933. When her husband, Philip Graham, who was publisher of the Post, committed suicide in 1963, she assumed control. Woodward was glad that Mrs. Graham had waited until after the intense period of major investigative stories and the attack by the White House in the fall before asking for a meeting. He took the elevator to the 8th floor and walked through the double glass doors onto the thick white carpet that led to her office. Simons was already there, a drink in hand, and the three of them sat down in a corner.
"What's happening in the trial today?" Mrs. Graham asked.
Woodward told her about the guilty pleas by the four Miami men and Sirica's interrogation. The trial was getting increasingly ridiculous, Woodward said, and described the scene of the four men talking and nodding as if on cue. Mrs. Graham asked several questions about what it all might mean and what would happen.
"Is it all going to come out?" she asked, somewhat apprehensively. "I mean, are we ever going to know about all of this?"
Woodward thought it was the nicest way possible of asking, "What have you boys been doing with my newspaper?" He said that he and Bernstein weren't sure it would ever come out. Depression seemed to register on her face, and she shook her head.
"Never?" she asked. "Don't tell me never."
She laughed, throwing her head back with a bright smile.
"Well, let's eat," she said,
rising and leading them to the dining room directly behind her office. A woman in a traditional maid's uniform of black and white served Eggs Benedict. Howard Simons outlined the purpose of the lunch, a confidential discussion of the sources for the Watergate stories. Months later, Howard Simons summarized his private feelings about the Post's position during the trial. "I had this nagging feeling that the Watergate might turn out like the Reichstag fire. You know, 40 years from now, will people still be asking, did the guy said it? And was he a German, or was he just a crazy Dutchman? I'll tell you, it's like being in a bathtub where scientifically, you know, you turn the water a little bit hotter at a time and burn yourself to death without realizing it, because the increments are so small that the body doesn't understand or feel. That's the difference between Watergate and the Pentagon Papers. In the Pentagon Papers, damn, you have the lawyers involved the first day, getting advice, and Catherine actually making the decision to publish. Nothing like that happened with Watergate. We never called the lawyers and said, are we okay? What's the legal view of this? I do think we did slip into it. It was incremental." Woodward had finished two bites of his Eggs Benedict, and now he was going to have to give a monologue. He told her about Martin Dardis in Florida, several Justice Department attorneys, an FBI agent, a White House aide, the bookkeeper, Hugh Sloan. Mrs. Graham said she was less interested in the names than in the positions they held. Woodward said that he had told no one the name of Deep Throat. Mrs. Graham paused.
"Tell me," she said.
Woodward froze. He said he would give her the name if she wanted. He was praying she wouldn't press it. Mrs. Graham laughed, touched his arm, and said she was only kidding. She didn't really want to carry that burden around with her. Woodward took a bite of his eggs, which were cold. "Now, about the Haldeman business," Mrs. Graham said, looking as if she were not sure she wanted to hear it. Woodward put down his fork and told the story of the mistake he and Bernstein had made about Sloan's grand jury testimony.
"But you're absolutely sure we're right?"
The question carried an intensity absent from the previous conversation.
"I remember talking with Henry Kissinger," she continued, "and he came up and said, 'What's the matter? Don't you think we're going to be reelected? You were wrong on Haldeman.' And he seemed upset and said something about it being terribly, terribly unfair."
"If there's anyone who has not been wronged," Woodward said, "it is Bob Haldeman." It was the most definite statement Woodward made during lunch.
Oh, really? Said Mrs. Graham. I'm glad to hear you say that, because I was worried. She paused. You've reassured me. You really have. She looked at Woodward. Her face said, Do better. The trial lasted another 2 weeks. Woodward and Bernstein continued to attend, sifting through exhibits and papers filed with the court. Woodward copied down the phone numbers and the defendants' address books, which were entered into evidence, and one evening he called some of the numbers. The FBI? One man asked. They never, never contacted me. I never talked to them. Woodward slammed down the phone. In the biggest, most wide-ranging investigation since the assassination of President Kennedy, the FBI didn't even call the numbers in the address books? While going through the list of witnesses, Woodward found one who knew Hunt quite well. He called the witness at his office and asked what he was going to testify about. The witness said, I'll tell you what I could testify about, but Silbert won't ask. If the judge does, or any of the attorneys, I'll say it. Woodward sat up straight in the large blue chair at his desk and asked what that testimony might include. Howard always used they or the White House when he was talking about his activities. But one day, I remember he was complaining about Ehrlichman and saying what an amateur Ehrlichman was, because Ehrlichman put a hold on a lot of things Howard was doing, various secret intelligence-type things. The operation was delayed for 2 or 3 weeks because Ehrlichman was holding up the budget. Ehrlichman? Woodward snapped a pencil in half between his fingers. And Howard was saying that was why he liked Coulson, because Coulson understood that such things are necessary. Coulson is an operator and gave immediate approval. He pushed the budget through. Coulson, that made sense, but Ehrlichman? Woodward lined up several neat rows of paperclips on his desk as the witness went on. From the comments Howard made, it was apparent that Mitchell was getting typed reports of the wiretaps. Okay, Woodward thought, that made sense. After the Watergate arrests, when Howard was out of town hiding and needed a lawyer, Howard was looking for John Dean and said, Let him get me a lawyer. Woodward's hand jerked through the neat rows of paperclips, destroying the symmetry. John Dean? He asked. That's exactly how Silbert sounded when I told him, the witness said. He said that's the first time his tracks have appeared in this. Woodward took one of his giant paperclips, bent it into a large L, and began twirling it in his hand as he read over his notes. At that moment, Bradley walked by his desk and asked what was up. Maybe a whole lot, and maybe nothing, Woodward said. But there was at least one witness who could do some damage to Mitchell, Coulson, Ehrlichman, and John Dean. Bradley's eyes brightened. He did a little dance, holding an imaginary towel to his ass and wiggling it back and forth before walking off. Woodward thought fleetingly of getting in touch with Judge Sirica or one of his law clerks and somehow letting it be known that this witness could answer a few interesting questions. He rejected the notion. The witness was never asked those questions, but in a later conversation with Woodward, he explained why Hunt was staying silent about high-level involvement. In his lexicon of values, the witness said, Howard is performing a heroic act. He's like a medieval monk who goes to meditate in a high place in the hope that it'll get him into heaven. Howard wants to become the Alger Hiss of the right. The trial dragged on. During recesses, Liddy and McCord were accessible and would chat frequently in the corridors with reporters. Liddy delighted in telling little anecdotes, like the one about a military plane that accidentally dropped a bomb in the red light district of a Mexican border town. So the town officials paid a visit to the military base, he told a dozen reporters one morning, and they told the base commander that if he would stop bombing the cat houses, they would close them down. Liddy roared at his own story, laughing so convulsively that his face turned bright red. At one point, after Liddy's lawyer, Peter Marullis, had another one of his frequent objections overruled by Sirica, Liddy took Woodward aside in the corridor. "Do you know how to play chess?" Liddy asked conspiratorially. Woodward did and told Liddy so. "Well, Peter just took their queen," Liddy said. "What do you mean?" Woodward asked. "Listen, that's all I can tell you. He got their queen." Woodward asked if that meant that the judge had committed an error on which the higher courts would be forced to reverse any convictions.
"You're a good chess player," Liddy said, beaming and bouncing up and down slightly with his hands in his pockets.
On January 23rd, the only witnesses